Again, good morning, everyone. My name is Pam Yonke, farm broadcaster, Madison, Wisconsin. We are so grateful for the opportunity to visit with U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, sworn in as our 30th Secretary of the USDA in the month of January. He has been very involved as a public servant. Mayor, state senator, governor of Iowa, has been making a positive impact on folks in Iowa for quite a little while, and now he is here in the nation's capital to help working farmers across the countryside and anyone that is looking for leaders in renewable energy production and rural economic stimulation. Is just a few of the talons of USDA that he will be under his charge as leader. USDA is working right now to promote sustainable, sufficient, and nutritious food supply for everyone in the United States. And Secretary Vilsack is working to make sure that conservation of our natural resources and rural communities remains a priority. Let's give a warm welcome to our 30th Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Mr. Tom Vilsack. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Man, thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning and look forward to some dialogue as well as an opportunity to respond to some of your questions. Let me first of all start by pointing out our effort at USDA to make sure that people here in Washington, D.C. and across the country understand the scope and breadth of what USDA does. We now refer to ourselves as an everyday, every way department. And I think as I review some of the things that have occurred over the course of the last 100 days, I think you'll see why we think we are an everyday, every way department. First and foremost, obviously, we had a responsibility when we began this effort to implement the 2008 Farm Bill. And we have been aggressively promoting several titles of that Farm Bill to get that process started. The President gave me an instruction when he hired me to continue to promote renewable energy and biofuels, and for that reason we've been very focused on making sure that the energy title of the Farm Bill was accelerated in terms of rulemaking and in terms of making resources available to farmers and rural communities across the country. There are several aspects of that energy bill and energy title that we're working on. There is the resources for additional biorefineries. There are resources for farmers who will be producing alternative feedstocks in addition to corn-based ethanol. There are resources available for communities who want to transition to more renewable energy and fuel. There are resources for farmers to conduct audits of their own farmland and farm operations to determine whether or not they could incorporate renewable energy and fuel into their mix. So there is an aggressive effort through the use of some regulatory procedures to get those resources available to farmers. We hope to be able to begin making awards and grants under a number of the programs sometime this summer. We've already begun to make grants under the REAP program for the audits that I mentioned. We've already begun the process of putting out research and development grants in conjunction with the Department of Energy. So Farm Bill implementation, we've also worked hard to try to get the sign-ups extended so that farmers have an opportunity to make sure that they can make an informed choice with the new acre program in terms of what will fit their operations best. So again, extending the payment deadline, making sure the acre program rules were put out as quickly as we possibly get them out, part of the focus of the first 100 days. But you would expect that. You would expect that from USDA. What you might not expect is reflected in the work that has been done in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. As you know, the President and Congress worked hard in the first 100 days to pass the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, designed to stimulate the economy, to get people back to work doing the work that Americans want done. And there's probably no department in the federal government that has been more aggressive in trying to get resources out into the economy than USDA. Now, let me just give you a couple of the statistics that we've compiled by virtue of the first 100 days. First and foremost, we began with the increase in SNAP benefits. A lot of folks don't realize that two-thirds of the USDA budget is actually in the form of food assistance, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program is a critical component of that food assistance effort. We increased benefits under the Recovery and Reinvestment Act. You might ask yourself, why or how is that a stimulus effect on an economy? Well, for every $5 that is invested in the SNAP program, there is about $9.20 of economic activity generated. If you think about it, if you give people more money to spend in the grocery store, that means that more products have to be shelved. Somebody's got to do that work. More products have to be trucked into the grocery store. Someone has to do that work. More product has to be processed. Someone has to do that work. More product obviously has to be grown and produced. Someone has to do that work. That creates markets for our farmers and ranchers and jobs for folks who work throughout the United States. We have put those SNAP benefits into effect starting April 1st, and on average, a family of four might see somewhere in the neighborhood of $80 to $100 more of assistance. That's making a difference. But we do more than that. We provide direct farm operating loans. More than 2,500 farmers throughout the country have received a total of $168 million in direct operating loans. I'm proud to say that 20%, nearly 20% of those were socially disadvantaged farmers, and close to 50% of them were beginning farmers. As we look at the Ag Census that was published shortly after I came into office, what we see is a growth in small production operations, operations that might have several thousand dollars in sales, 108,000 new operations in that category. These are mostly fruits, vegetables, growers. We want to promote that. We saw an increase in large production agriculture operations, about 40,000 more farmers in that category. What we did see, however, was a decrease in the mid-sized operations. So these direct farm loans are important, and it's important for us to continue to look for ways to assist our beginning farmers. We just announced $17 million of additional assistance and help in our beginning farmer program. In addition to that, we also are in the housing business. If USDA were a bank, based on the amount of loans that we do during the course of a year and our portfolio, we'd be, I think, the seventh largest bank in the country. Through the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, we have obligated almost $750 million of single-family housing loans, which will help almost 6,500 families recognize that part of the American dream of home ownership. In addition, we also provided up to $10 billion in loan guarantees through our housing program, which will provide the opportunity for those to get commercial financing at more competitive rates or be able to access commercial financing when they might not otherwise be able to get it without the guarantee. Again, thousands of families in rural communities will benefit from this program. In addition to that, we also are in the process of working hard to expand access to broadband. We're working in the Department of Commerce. The USDA has about $2.5 billion of resources in the form of grants and loans available to expand broadband to unserved areas. This is an important component to rural development. Without it, it will be difficult to access the opportunities of a 21st century economy. We know that there are many parts of the country, particularly in rural areas, that don't have access to this new technology, and it's important that we work hard to expand it. USDA is going to be actively involved, and we anticipate sometime this spring, early summer, that we'll begin to see rules and regulations relative to these grant programs, and hopefully by fall we've got resources out into rural communities to help build that network. We also, as you know, have responsibility for the Forest Service. Additional resources have been provided through the Forest Service. Roughly 10% of the money allocated to the Forest Service has already been spent to improve our national forest system and also to promote wildfire protection. We are also in the business of community facilities. I was in North Carolina with the vice president, and we were at a fire station. The USDA is involved in helping to build fire stations, healthcare clinics, a wide variety of resources going to be helped with several hundred million dollars of assistance through the Recovery and Reinvestment Act to build community facilities so that we have strong rural communities. We're also involved in watershed protection, flood protection, again, additional resources. $45 million has been allocated by the USDA for rehabilitation of watersheds. We have about $85 million for new flood prevention efforts in 21 states, all of that being done in the first 100 days, and there is much more through the Recovery and Reinvestment Act to do. Over the course of the next 12 to 18 months, you're going to see us invest in business and industry development in rural communities, in wastewater treatment facilities, in a new home, new housing opportunities, as well as community facilities, all designed to build and bolster rural communities. Why is that important? Because 900,000 of the 2.2 million farmers and ranchers in this country require at least 200 days of off-farm income in order to maintain their operations. The reality is, unless you're a very, very large operation, you need off-farm income either for the farmer and rancher or his or her spouse or family member. So it is important for us to surround our farms and ranches with vibrant rural communities, creating job opportunities that help support agriculture. We've also been busy reforming matters in USDA. We've been looking for ways, based on the instructions from the President, to spend resources more wisely. We are consolidating operations, for example. We're going to take a number of leased premises and consolidate them into a single premise. Over the course of a 15-year period, it'll save USDA $62 million. We've looked at ways in which we can better utilize our technology, again, about a $17 million savings. Over time, we've also taken a look at reducing travel. With video conferencing, we now see the opportunity for us to use the technology here in Washington to have meetings across the country in our various offices, rather than having people come and fly them to Washington and spend a substantial amount of money for travel expense. And we're also working with the Department of the Treasury to make sure that we are giving farm payments to those who actually are entitled to them. We will be working on a pilot project basis to periodically check information that is supplied by farmers when they sign up for programs against tax returns that the Treasury Department will have. The tax returns will not be at the FSA offices. They won't be here at USDA. We'll just simply be doing a numbers check. The GAO did a report some time ago that if the farm bill had been in the current farm bill had been in place, there would have been roughly $23 million of payments made to people who were not on a yearly basis, who were not entitled to them. So this is a opportunity for us to make sure that we are only providing assistance to farmers and ranchers who qualify. We've been working very hard on the issue of civil rights. This department has been plagued with a number of cases for several decades, raising issues relative to civil rights. We just came out with a fairly aggressive effort, both internally and externally. We're reviewing all civil rights claims that were filed from 2000 on to make sure that they were handled properly. We're going to do a complete review of our policies and procedures to make sure that we're administering them as fairly and as reasonably and as balanced as we possibly can. We have taken a timeout in terms of some of the foreclosure actions against some of the farmers to make sure that we're doing everything we possibly can to keep folks on the farm and make sure that we have not violated any agreements or settlement agreements that have been in place. And we're working with the Department of Justice and the Office of Budget and Management to try to see if we can resolve some of these outstanding cases in a more expeditious way than we have in the past. So that's been part of our activity. And we've also been working and focusing on policy initiatives. This is a big year for nutrition. We want to make sure that we send a strong message about the importance of nutrition. And so with the school reauthorization, the Nutrition Reauthorization Acts, the school lunch and school breakfast program, we're going to make a concerted effort to put more resources into those programs so that schools have the capacity to buy fruits and vegetables and make that part of our children's diets. Why is that important? Well, health care. Again, USDA intersecting at various areas of policy. Health care, somewhere in the neighborhood of 30-35% of our children are either overweight or at risk of being overweight. And we know that that carries with it significant consequences as they move into adulthood. If we can do a better job of providing more nutritious meals, and if we can do a better job of making our children have more physical activity, we can reduce those percentages, I think, significantly, and therefore save them and save us a lot of money and a lot of stress later on in life. Healthcare, obviously, is a big focus of this administration, and this is part of the strategy. Prevention is part of the strategy, and wellness and physical activity is certainly important parts of it. We're also going to make sure that we create opportunities for those who grow those fruits and vegetables to be able to market them in local markets. We want to better connect local producers with local purchasing opportunities. That is one of the reasons why we started the People's Garden Initiative, to sort of send the message that it's important to produce these nutritious foods. It's important to make sure that they get marketed properly. Here at USDA, our fruits and vegetables that we're going to grow here on the grounds will be used to provide resources for food banks. But we're hoping through a number of programs in the Farm Bill to connect those local producers with local purchasing opportunities, schools, and other institutional purchasers, so that we create additional markets for those 108,000 new entrepreneurs who have started farming in the last 5 years in that small farmer category. We're also working very hard on food safety. This is obviously a significant issue. I'm co-chairing with soon to be confirmed, hopefully today, Kathleen Sebelius of Health and Human Services, and co-chairing a working group that the President announced several weeks ago. That group has already begun meeting at the staff level to establish the framework for our conversation and discussion about food safety. We are one of the few industrialized nations that has more than one agency involved in food safety. In fact, we have 15 agencies involved in food safety. We do not have a single philosophy that guides all 15 of those agencies. At USDA, we're focused on prevention. At FDA, we're focused more on mitigation. We need to have a consistency in philosophy. We need to have better communication between the agencies. I think we need to take a look at the enforcement capacity that that each has to be able to stop a problem once it's identified. We at USDA obviously have the capacity to walk out of a slaughterhouse, but FDA does not have that kind of capacity in the face of problems with all of the food that they basically regulate. So you can expect that the working group will be taking a look at what kind of recall authority each agency ought to have in order to protect consumers. This department is as much about consumers as it is about producers, and I think it's important for people to understand that without consumers having confidence in the food supply, then it makes it that much more difficult for farmers and ranchers to basically be able to market their product. So it's important for us to continue to maintain a confidence level in our food supply. 75 million Americans have a foodborne illness at some point in time in the year. 325,000 are hospitalized, 5,000 die. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that that aren't necessarily related to how food is produced or how it's processed. It may be how it's handled at home. But the reality is that those are very large numbers, and we have to obviously be concerned about them, and we have to address them in a very serious way. So if you take a look at the totality of what we're doing, and then you also recognize that we're playing an integral role in discussions of climate change, you can see it's been a very active 100 days, and it's the broad spectrum of activities that USDA is involved in. It isn't just farm payments. It's food assistance. It isn't just food assistance. It's the Forest Service. It isn't just the Forest Service. It's rural development and various components of rural development. That's why I think it's fair to say that we're an everyday, every way department. With that, glad to answer questions. Pam, you're in charge.
Let's start with clarification on where we stand to date at this moment with the swine flu situation and USDA's involvement, please.
First of all, what USDA has been attempting to do is to make sure that people here in the United States and around the world appreciate that it is not the consumption of pork or pork products that is the cause or linkage to swine flu. It's obviously very important for us to convey that message. And so in our website, in our communiques, in our public statements, we emphasize that at the beginning. We are also encouraging those who will be speaking about swine flu in from a different perspective, Department of Homeland Security Secretary and others, to basically reinforce that message. That's the first thing. Secondly, we've been working hand in glove with the pork producers to make sure that, and we've had conference calls with them, to make sure that their message and our message is very consistent, to make sure that there's a linkage between what they are saying and what we're saying and what we're putting on the web and what they're putting on the web. Third, we have reached out to all 50 ag secretaries and commissioners and state veterinarians in the 50 states to ask them to give us information in terms of whether or not they have detected any pig with swine flu. We have not received any indication today that any pig is infected in the United States, which is important. We want to make sure that we are up to date in terms of our awareness, and so we've put that process out. We've also encouraged with the pork producers some common sense set of instructions for those who are taking care of our hogs to make sure that they take care of them in the proper way to minimize any potential risk. And we've been working with our international trade partners, with the State Department, with the USTR. We have had our field operatives in various countries basically convey the same kind of message that pork products and pork are not responsible for this in terms of consumption, that if you properly handle and properly cook the pork, it kills the viruses and the pathogens. That message has been conveyed to a number of different in a number of different ways to a number of different countries. And we are continuing to monitor the situation, continuing to try to make sure that our trading partners understand that. We recognize that some have taken steps, and we're in the process of trying to continue to educate them that to focus their attention and their resources where it needs to be focused on, which is avoiding or preventing human-to-human transmission.
Mr. Secretary, it's been suggested by the World Health Organization that it not be called the swine flu.
Hey, I'm all for that. I suggested that, call it the H1N1 flu, call it something other than swine flu. I mean, and the fact is, to show you how sensitive I am to this, I think it was the Department of Homeland Security or some website that had hogs on their website when I asked our folks to let them know that, why don't you just take that picture off? And, you know, you can convey messages about the need for care to prevent illness, which is important, and that's the primary concern right now, is to make sure that we can contain this and to make sure that there are the fewest possible sicknesses and fatalities possible. And I think that's the goal of every government, and should be. But we want to make sure that we're conveying the right set of messages. Pam, you're in charge here.
Okay. Ken?
Mr. Secretary, the issue of climate change seems to be emerging in this new administration. And agriculture is a bit confused as to whether or not they're going to be an asset or a liability in this, depending on livestock or crops. Can you give us any direction on how you think this is going to go?
You know, I honestly, Ken, I don't think they should be confused about this at all. I think this is a great opportunity for agriculture, whether you're in the livestock business or whether you're in the crop business. The reason I say that is that virtually every study that I've seen that tries to quantify the extent to which agriculture contributes to greenhouse gases and the extent to which it can minimize or reduce greenhouse gases is a net plus for agriculture. Most studies I see say that we are somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 10% of the emissions, but we are 20 to 25% of the solution. And that involves creating a robust method of offsets that agriculture can participate in and that can that reassure farmers and ranchers that there may, in fact, be an income opportunity in all of this for agriculture. Now, that's not true in a lot of other sectors of the economy. In a lot of other sectors of the economy, there are going to be some concerns and issues as to how this all plays out. But I think it's an opportunity for us. And I think that there's no question that this is a transitional moment for the economy of the United States. We're going to begin moving away from an economy that has been, to a certain extent, not necessarily built on, but to a certain extent based on pollution and waste, to one that's going to be based on clean energy and clean opportunities. And I think agriculture, both in terms of how we raise crops, how we fertilize our crops, what kind of cover crops we use, what kind of procedures and processes we use to put the crop in the ground, is tremendous opportunity. On the livestock side, there are not far from here, there's a experiment taking place with feed to livestock that substantially reduces methane. There are ways, obviously, to capture methane, to convert it into energy, and so it is about change, and people are always concerned about that. But I think on this particular side, agriculture has a very important role to play. And it is important for us to be at the table. as this is formulating and as this is being shaped. The worst thing we can do is to sort of take the attitude that we don't want to be part of this, because if you're not part of the conversation, then you're not going to be in that offset discussion, and you're not going to be in the discussion when this whole process is formulated. So I have made sure in this administration that the USDA is always at the table. I have advocated very strongly in task force meetings and interagency work group meetings that agriculture must play a role, and it needs to be specifically articulated that the role it plays. So I'm hopeful that people see this as an opportunity.
Jeff Nally.
Mr. Secretary, I think farmers have always had a great relationship when they're working just with the USDA. If you go back to the 80s, the sod buster, the swamp buster, and then especially wetlands, when we got out of USDA and started having to deal with Corps of Engineers and EPA, that's when some of the troubles began. We hear of the Clean Water Act of removing navigable waterways for a larger land grab for the Corps and for the EPA, and regulating dust and methane from livestock. What role is the department playing and the other cabinet agencies on these issues that could really devastate farmers and their producing?
Well, I have made a special effort, and I think Lisa Jackson, who's the EPA administrator, has made a special effort to create a line of communication that is very, very solid and is very personal. In other words, Lisa and I have had an opportunity on occasion to actually share a lunch together. We've had an opportunity to talk about various issues. So the line of communication, first and foremost, has to be open. The worst thing that can happen here is for USDA to take sort of an opposite track to what EPA is all about, and you create this conflict, and then there's no communication, and then these agencies go off and do their own thing. It's important for USDA to be helping EPA understand the consequence of what they're considering. So, for example, I think we've made a difference by virtue of that line of communication. I think we've made a difference in EPA accelerating their consideration and widening their consideration on the blend wall issue for ethanol. We have been insistent on the necessity of some greater flexibility in that blend wall, because we're bumping up against the wall. We've got an important industry that's sort of an infant industry that's going through a tough time now, and increasing that percentage, even if it's just a percent or two, or even it's 15, from 10 to 15, or from 10 to 12, or 10 to whatever it is, that's going to help. Okay, it's going to create more market opportunities, and it's going to help. So we've made a very concerted effort to try to educate EPA about the status of that industry, about how tenuous it is and how important it is to the president's goals of promoting biofuels and renewable energy that we maintain the infrastructure. Okay, part of what we've done at USDA, by the way, is to also take a look at how we might be able to help in terms of it, to the extent that we can use our credit and our loan guarantee power that's available to sit down with ethanol producers and processors and say, can we sit down with you and your banker and figure out ways in which we can help you get through this tough time? And I think we are also have done a good job of educating the EPA about precisely the consequences of defining indirect land use as it relates to the impact of on greenhouse gases of biofuels. I think to the extent that they now recognize that whatever they're proposing and whatever they will propose really needs to be sort of reviewed by outside third-party validators to make sure that it's accurate, because that's a very important calculation, and if we get it wrong, the consequences can be pretty significant. So we're asking them, would you consider putting your work out there for critique, for review, so that you are certain, and we are certain, that this is the right approach. And I think that they are open to that. And, I'd like to think that we had something to do with that.
Broadcasters, let's keep the questions concise. The Secretary's on a schedule, and we have a photo op yet. Chuck?
Actually, I think that was directed to me. Keep my answers concise.
There you go, Pam.
Yeah, there we go.
Chuck Zimmerman, AgWire.com. pointing to rural development. The previous administration was very aggressive in helping promote broadband accessibility out in rural America. Can you just comment about the plans that you may have at this point, especially with some of the maybe stimulus funds that you would have control over? And then just a last quick question. When we meet again, is it possible we could have internet access to use within the room here?
Let me see if I can respond to the first part of your question. The way in which USDA has approached the broadband resources in terms of grants and loans has been subject to some review and criticism in terms of where it has been directed. There have been circumstances and situations where money went into areas that probably aren't what we would consider rural, or areas in which there was already broadband access and it was just a matter of getting a second carrier so that maybe the prices would be a smidge more competitive. The focus that we have been directed to do and that we think is the right focus for today, given the recovery and reinvestment resources, as well as our basic budget resources, our general budget resources, is to focus on unserved areas. Now, there's a reason why they're unserved. It may be that they're few people. It may be that that the level of income and is insufficient to support what would be a traditional rate structure. And so we have to be creative about how we go about actually expanding this opportunity. Why is this important? Because for farmers and ranchers, it's clearly important because it allows them to get, even though they listen to all your broadcasts and they get up-to-date information, it allows them to make real-time decisions, which is, in this world, really important. But it's also important in terms of creating opportunities for small businesses to expand their markets beyond the local market. If you're making something that's unique, you can sell it to the folks who can drive or who happen to be going through town. But with the internet, you can sell it to the entire world. Now, all of a sudden, you have significantly greater opportunities. And third, there are many people that have the capacity to do their work with just simply a computer, so long as they're connected to their place of business. And I think there are many folks who are looking for perhaps a different place for their families to be raised, but they don't have the capacity to be where they want to be because they can't work. So to the extent that we can do this, we create those opportunities. So that's why it's important. And, you know, our focus is going to be on those unserved areas. Now, I don't know about Larry. Can we help
this
these folks out?
This unserved area? Bob Bosel?
Mr. Secretary, Bob Bosel from Wisconsin. A couple of quick questions. A few weeks ago, you took product off the market, 200 million pounds of dairy, lamb, walnuts, and others. Any plans to do any more of that? And also, where are we on the voluntary versus mandatory animal ID, since you and the Congress are at odds, evidently?
Let me just simply say on the ID that we're in the process. We began just actually here in this room a week or so ago, a beginning process of listening to people on both sides of this issue in an effort to try to determine whether or not we can figure out a way to do this better than it's currently being done. There is an inconsistency from state to state. Wisconsin is quite good about this. Other states don't have quite the participation rate. There's a lot of angst about a mandatory system relating to confidentiality and privacy and cost. We're going to have a series of listening opportunities around the country that will be announced here pretty soon. And after those listening opportunities, what we hope to be able to do is to put together, with the assistance of Congress, a proposal that might improve the situation. Here's the issue. A recent study just came out suggesting that if we had an incident and we couldn't contain that incident, that we could have multiple billions of dollars of losses in the market from just one incident. We all know that that's possible. The question is, how do we minimize those losses? Well, an identification system that's more pervasive than the one we have today might be of assistance. It's costly. We need to think about that. But you're dealing with hundreds of millions of dollars of cost versus billions of dollars of loss. So the question is, how do we solve that dilemma? So we're in the process of listening on that. As it relates to dairy, you know, we're obviously very concerned about the industry. We've authorized the milk payments, and we anticipate that there may be, by the time it's all said and done, over $1 billion in milk payments made. We've obviously taken commodities off the shelf, so to speak. We're looking at other options. I can't commit to you today that we'll actually follow through on other options, but we're taking a look at other options that might be available. We are examining at this point export assistance, the export assistance program. Can't commit to you today because we have to work through the system that we're that I'm involved in. I found out, Ken, that this is a lot different than being governor. You're not totally in charge. You got other people you gotta satisfy before you can actually do things. But so we're sensitive. We're looking at other options, and hopefully we'll be able to make some decisions on those fairly quickly.
Thank you, Don.
This fellow over here, right here, has been very polite. So don't forget him.
You mentioned Farm Bill implementation. We're in a part of the world that's got a little bit too much water right now. I'm in the Red River Valley. What's the process timeline as you look at the permanent disaster program, the SURE program?
The Recovery and Reinvestment Act tweaked some of the conditions of that particular proposal, and so therefore we're in the process. We were working diligently. Now we have to sort of take a couple of steps back because of the congressional tweaks. Our hope is that we've got rules out in the fall and that we're in the position to make payments sometime after the first of the year in 2010. As it relates to North Dakota, I will say that we did identify $750,000 of assistance, particularly to livestock operators, in order to try to figure out how to either get feed to their cattle or how to get the cattle to dry land so that they could be fed, which I think was helpful. And we responded fairly quickly to the senators and governors requesting that.
Troy?
Troy Leininger from KICD in Spencer, Iowa. And
that's the reason why we want to.
Yeah. Got to work on that. We've mentioned the dust particulate matter a little bit, and that's something that's kind of got all of my neck of the woods, because not only has it influenced the production agriculture on the crops and the harvesting with the dust, the particulate matter coming out of the exhaust fans, and then even our gravel roads could be, you know, a problem.
Well, you know, I just want to caution everybody that not to get too carried away with rules and regulations, because I think there's a tendency for us to sort of think worst case scenario when folks who are formulating these rules and regulations are not really thinking about worst case scenario. They're thinking about a completely different set of circumstances. So I'm not confident at this point that we're going to be shutting down agriculture or shutting down your gravel roads just outside of Spencer. I just don't think that's going to happen.
But if they make the rule, we have to live by it.
Well, you know, that's a big if. It's a big if.
Well, we're tight on time. Roger?
Roger Ward, WLDS, Jacksonville, Illinois. You mentioned the consolidation of some of the offices here. A couple of years back, there was talk about closing FSA offices. Is that perhaps in the sequence of next events?
Well, as you probably know, the Congress has weighed in on that, and they've restricted our capacity to take a look at office closings. We're very restricted and can't do it without. The only way we can do it is if there are offices within 20 miles of each other, and or if we were moving from one location to another because our lease was expired. There at this point in time, there is no plan to consolidate any additional offices, and if there were a plan, we'd have to go through congressional oversight on that. What we are looking at is ways in which we can use our resources that we do have control over more efficiently and more effectively. We are looking at, for example, we're looking at, or will look at, we haven't started this, but we will be looking at the 103,000 or so folks who work at USDA. There are obviously vacancies that occur from time to time. We have, I know, an aging workforce. Our workforce is a little bit older than the traditional average workforce out in the private sector. So we have to sort of prepare for a series of retirements. I can't remember the statistics right now, but I think well over almost 60% of our workforce is over the age of 45, and it compares, that's a much higher number than the average private sector workforce. So we're going to be taking a look at what do we do with those vacancies. Do we move them around? Do we shift them? Are there places where we're light in terms of people? Are there places where we're top-heavy in terms of people? We want to conduct a review of that, but we have not started that, and we really, frankly, don't even yet have a confirmed assistant secretary of administration. As soon as we have one of those, we'll get to work on that.
Good, nice call on Doug Caruso. Tell him the farm babe said hey.
Okay.
Last question, Gary Cooper.
Appreciate it. Mr. Secretary, I believe one of your very first meetings in office was with the Florida citrus growers on the fresh side of the business, USDA research showing that canker can't be spread by harvested fruit, and in order for them to go fresh in the fall, they need to know pretty quick about how to handle their crop, and we're just wondering if anything is being looked at in terms of adjusting the shipping rules for canker area fruit.
I don't know specifically about that, and we will get back to you on that. As I sit here today, the last discussion we had is making sure that there were additional research efforts in terms of trying to figure out precisely how to handle that situation. I don't know about the shipping. We'll check on that and get back to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's give a round of applause to Secretary Vilsack, and let's leave your equipment.